How would you rate the Indian response, the way India reacted to COVID?
I would say they did what wise government should do, which is, in the absence of information, you don't take risks. You just make sure that you're minimizing risks. We had no idea what this disease was about. And then, as my friend here, Sanjeev, explained, as you gain more information, then you relax the measures. You see, if I have absolutely no idea about the safety of the plane, I ground it. And then, as I get more information about the plane, I will, let it fly with caution. So basically, that's a precautionary principle. And I think that that measure was extremely wise. And I wish, as a matter of fact, we had such wisdom here, because in the United States, we had a severe problem. It took us an entire year before the federal government mandated PCRs at the border, which could have solved the problem and saved trillions of dollars. So basically, sometimes even from an economic standpoint, being acting quickly can help you in the long run. And then let me warn about one thing, the hindsight explanation. You know, after a fact, you know, I wasn't sick last year. I didn't need health insurance after the fact. Okay. So I paid so much money for nothing. Yeah, it was wasted. It's the same argument can be used in any situation where someone is acting in a precautionary way by having, you know, the equivalent of insurance, which is taking for enacting measures and of course measures and policies that are there to minimize risk for the population.
So was this a black swan event? If yes, why? If no, why?
I see. I have a little 12 minutes presentation explaining the thinking that was in the black swan. How I explained in the black swan that, of course, it wouldn't be a black swan event. It was the black swan itself on page 307 explained. It's, tells you that this is almost unavoidable because of the structure of the world in which we live today. So let me quickly, may I run now through the presentation?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, great. So let me explain the center of the idea of the black swan, and as explained in the book, and the black swan being part of the Inserto, five volume book plus technical papers and academic work associated with it. So the center of the idea is the difference between what I call mediocristan and extremistan. So let me explain the difference. We are used to variables like mediocristan that vary, but not too much. So just to explain, to give you the thought experiment in the beginning of the black swan. If I gather 1,000 people, invite them, to New York, and there's a lot of, room in hotels in New York. Okay, so it could be a good idea. Put them on a scale and weigh them. And then I add to that scale a rare event, a consequential rare event. The largest possible person I can find on the planet. How much of the total will that person represent? Or in other words, how much will the total change? Peanuts, 0.3%, maybe 0.4%, if I have the heaviest person on the planet. Okay. Now, if I have 10,000 people, it'd be 0.04%. So basically, when you have a large sample, and you have a lot of variables. So you have it's an environment in which exceptions do not cost you much. They can happen. They do not represent a big share of the total. Now, when I move to extremistan, it's a complete different class of random variables. And that's not one that was examined in schools too much by the people who know statistics 101, but your grandmother knows very well what's going on. So in extremistan, okay, things can be determined by the extreme. Let's play the same thought experiment and have the same 1,000 people. We brought them to New York randomly from the planet. And let's take their net worth, total net worth. If you're lucky, you get $200,000. Given what's going on a planet and some areas on the planet where people, don't make a lot of money. So You get maybe $1 million if you're lucky in that sample, total net worth. And then you add Jeff Bezos. Okay. So the fluctuation in the price of Amazon in the last nanosecond exceed the net worth of the balance, right? So basically, he'd be 100%. Okay. And or you can take, you know, you have four or five people representing 90-some percent of the total wealth. I mean, the bottom net worth, I mean, the bottom 3-4 billion have less than, in total, the net worth of Bezos. So you realize what's going on with concentration. So you have concentrated random variable. So I posited in the Black Swan that you have a switch towards extremistan by a lot of things, becoming even more from extremistan, owing to what? Well, from the fact that we no longer have islands, and when you switch from an island to a continent, when you join island together, okay, you have a drop of diversity and an increase of winner-take-all effects. So in the old days, no connectivity, the Google would not have survived. Harry Potter would not have been read in Lebanon, okay, 100 years ago. So and then the same thing then therefore will apply to pandemics. And that was in the Black Swan. You explain how pandemics will experience that winner take-all effects as we are increasing connectivity. We are more connected we are, and that's the, of course, Sanjeev's specialty, complexity theory, the more you have to look at it from a standpoint of complexity theory or theory associated with it. There are 7 or 8 different branches, but they all converge to the same point that you have networks, and these networks lead to concentration. Okay. So just like we had opera singers making a good living in the 1800s, okay, and then by 1995, Pavarotti and a few others were making 90% of the income. Same thing for soccer players, football players in UK English. So basically, what same happened. So now let's look at the effect of connectivity on diseases. There are villages in the UK, this is 330 years, okay? But in fact, I can go to 600 years. There are villages in the UK, in England, okay, that were reached by the bubonic plague between 300 and 600 years later. Just to tell you that connectivity was low. And of course, the Americas were not reached by the bubonic plague, you see, because you had the island effect. Today, we have no longer have an island effect. So think about the classes of diseases we are about to have and how different they are from what we were used to traditionally. That is, you know, that you got more from extremistan because of connectivity, you have conferences that bring people from the whole world to Las Vegas. Like you literally have conferences, and I've attended some, where people come from 120 countries. Okay. So, and then think about it. 3 days later, you're redistributing a disease to 120 countries. So what you have, so the bubonic plague at its fastest was traveling 30 miles a day. Okay, and look what's happening today. So basically, we live in a different world, more from extremistan, with winner-take-all effects for diseases. Meanwhile, our grandmothers know that. At least my grandmother, my grandfather, my granduncle as well. They understand the point. But some people who learn a little bit of statistics immediately thinks in terms of mediocristan. So what I call a fortune cookie science or fortune cookie thinking. When this fellow, in the beginning of COVID, we were fighting this misunderstanding of the properties of multiplicative things as compared to static, you know, non-multiplicative risks. And for example, this fellow was saying, oh, we don't shut down the country for swimming pool death. We have about 3,000 Americans die every year drowning in a swimming pool, compared to at the time you had only like 10 people that died of COVID. So they couldn't understand why we were more concerned by COVID than swimming pool death or fall from ladders, same order of magnitude, between 3,000 and 4,000 a year. Because if I drown in my swimming pool, my neighbor is not likely, more likely or less likely to drown in her or his swimming pool. As a matter of fact, maybe less likely, okay? Because as Mihir observed, you know, people become more cautious after. If I have a car accident, my neighbor is less likely to have a car accident, or equally likely, but not going to be more likely. Okay. However, if I get COVID, you bet the odds of my neighbor getting COVID has increased. And that's with multiplicative effects. And we have something called scale transformation. If the risk for an individual is low, the risk for a collective is higher because of these multiplicative effects. So you got to take these things seriously. Now, economically, we live in a world that has fragility to it increasingly. And you can see it from, I'm revising stuff I did in the Black Swan a few years later, okay, using data from 2018. And it's basically, we have the same rate of natural catastrophes as we did in the past. But the cost to GDP has increased markedly because of connectivity. Think about what's happening today in a Suez Canal. Okay, it's the same Suez Canal as it was 100 years ago or 150 years ago when the Lesseps did it. But think of traffic today, the impact on world GDP of the Suez Canal, okay, being blocked today as compared to 50 years ago, even 20 years ago. Because the more trade and the more connectivity, the more the weakest link affect us. And here, natural catastrophes have played a larger and larger role. Now, it's what I call this large movie theater with a small door effect. So economically, this is why the impact of some things can be greater. But this is not all bad news. Now, let's look at how the ancients dealt with it. The ancients had a huge, developed mechanism of lockouts, quarantines. The minute they heard of a rumor of any disease spreading anywhere, they enforced quarantine laws. So, for example, the Ottoman Empire, you wanted to go from India to anywhere controlled by the Ottoman, you had somewhere between 7 and 18 days of quarantine, depending on what they deemed was a risk. And that lasted for hundreds of years. Between the Habsburg Empire, this is called the Lazaretto, it was peppered. The whole border between the Habsburg and the Ottoman Empire was peppered with places like that, where they put you in for 40 days, up to 40 days. It's called a quarantine, you know, because it was up to 40 days, where they put the travelers. So just to make sure that what little connectivity they had did not harm them as much as what happened during Justinian's plague and, of course, the Great Plague in the 1300s. So basically, they understood. So now, let's say the ancients understood how to do it. Every port had quarantine. This is in Venice, for example. Some are nicer, of course. The Italians always had things nicer than other Mediterraneans, but it's the same concept applied everywhere around the Mediterranean. Marseille, Genoa, Beirut has a neighborhood called the quarantine because all the ships had to start to Beirut, and people had, because of the Ottoman law, had to be quarantined. So now what's happening, I conclude with the following, that something tells me that something in the East, and the East, I count myself as a Mediterranean, as part of the East, because this is our block of culture. We do not like geronticide. So I'm going to say that our grandparents, of course, would have understood the difference between COVID and drowning in the swimming pool, that something is multiplicative. They probably would not be able to articulate it, but they understood it. Likewise, they had moral values that have been absent in Northern Europe during this. So something tells me that the countries that did well through COVID would continue to do well in the future, whether economically, health-wise, medically, or I would say ethically. So because this idea of geronticide, of killing the elderly, is absolutely absent in Eastern and Indian and Mediterranean culture. And you can see what the respect we have for the elders, whereas Europe decided to say, okay, at some point, let's do herd immunity and let the elderly die. People don't realize that the word senator means elderly in Latin, and the word sheikh in Arabic means the eldest. So your seniority in society is inverse to what it is today in traditional societies. And you keep the elders because of their wisdom, because at least they can explain to you that this policy is wrong. And we're losing that. So that was my conclusion. And thank you very much for letting me present the main points of the Black Swan. And to insist that if there's something that's not a Black Swan, it is a pandemic. Thank you.
Right. Nassim, you want to add to that? You're saying something.
Yeah, yeah. I want to add, it's very simple. If you drive 50 miles an hour, you'll be okay arriving to destination. If you drive 500 miles an hour, the odds of getting to destination become zero. So this idea of speed, for example, so the fastest way to drive may be 50 miles per hour. You see, or 60 miles or 100 miles per hour, not 500. Likewise, the most efficient way, well, it's effectively, there's a difference between cosmetic efficiency, or I call pseudo-efficiency, and risk-adjusted efficiency. If you adjust by risk, okay, you know, so you get different results, and that's the resilience that our friend is talking about. Exactly. I mean, the whole idea is that of intergenerational commitment. Okay. For example, I treat my parents in a way that I would like my children to treat me, and my grandchildren to treat my children. So you have, these pacts, these intergenerational pacts that have arisen in the East, okay, with what we call the silver rule or the golden rule, that have unfortunately been eradicated by a bad economic culture that spread in Northern Europe. Over the past, whatever, since, you know, classical economy, neoclassical economics, you know, what I call the naive version of it, started spreading there. The fact that we believe in efficiency, we believe in, but it can't be too naive. That's a point. Exactly. So I classify things in four categories. Those who did well under COVID and will do well in the future. Those who did well under COVID, but we're not sure because, you know, it could be a transitory. Those who did poorly under COVID, like dentists, but or plastic surgeons, or you know, your family doctor, but will do well later, okay, because the demand, tourism, for example, and then of course the category of those who did poorly under COVID and will do poorly after. So let's focus on the first two categories: those who did well under COVID. Anyone in technology will tell you, okay, that COVID has been a blessing for them. And I'm going to give an example of two kind of people. There's this waiter, you know, in the restaurant I go to often, who, of course, New York, you know, shut down the restaurant, lost the job. So called up to say, can I offer some help? Say, are you kidding? What? I'm making three times at least the money I was making before. Say, what? Say, yes. How? Delivery, my friend. So you have two kind of people. Those who, when they're hit with something at the individual level, okay, they sit down and wait for the government to come rescue them, okay, and they become hopers. And then you have category of people who say, okay, there got to be some money to be made there. Let's make lemonade out of this lemon. There got to be some opportunity. There's got to be winds. Let's build windmills. Okay, so that category of people, and you see around. I saw a friend, another friend, same thing. He has a gym, and of course, gym were hit the hardest in America, and because you can't go to the gym, you still can't go to the gym. And so I called him up. He said, I'm making a fortune setting up gyms in people's homes, okay? And I luckily bought the equipment before, you know, these distortion supply chain, because you can't buy weights here. They're all made in China, and you have to wait 6 months. Anyway, so you have categories of people. So you can generalize to companies. Some companies have done well under COVID. So, and I think that some individuals have thrived, even, you know, family-wise under COVID. They know how to work Zoom, home office. So the first category, those that did well under COVID and will do well in the future, also, as I said, apply to countries. The countries that have done the best are Asian countries, who showed a lot of maturities in dealing with it. They understand liberty. Even Australia, I mean, okay, so maybe it's not very connected, so they benefited from being an island, but nevertheless, they showed that people in that part of the world, whether north or south, have shown an extremely high amount of wisdom. And then you see the foolishness from Sweden to the United States under Trump to the Northern Europe, other parts like France, even France now under Macron. So you see the foolishness of what's happening, and the lack of understanding of the urgency, and these false dichotomies. They think, oh no, you know, it hurts the economy to have. It doesn't hurt the economy to have lockdown. The Chinese proved that you help the economy by having lockdowns, provided you react quickly. So that first category, I think, is countries that did well. And then let's look at companies that did poorly under COVID and do poorly in the future. There are going to be some permanent changes in both consumer habits, okay, and professional practices. Like, for example, the COVID effect is seen in real estate, where you have an extraordinarily large amount of real estate for supplied in New York office space, because an office is a great place to work, but if you can work from home, the combination allows you to have a smaller office space and larger home office. So that reallocation is going to be because of nonlinearity, is going to be very destructive to New York City. We already see crime rising. We see a white collar flight. We see real estate prices collapsing in New York City, and this odds are will be permanent. I don't understand why people should put up with 2.5 hour commute if they can work on Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday out of their house. So I think the real estate prices understand that very well. The problem of cities like New York is that, as we saw in the 70s, there's a feedback loop that as people get out of New York, you end up with the elements, the dangerous elements in New York, completely uncontrolled. And so it leads to that some areas are going to be hurt permanently by it, some areas helped permanently by it. And one part of the economy that's going to be hurt very badly without any recovery is the U.S. Education. Okay, because let's think about it. Now people have learned that I can take a class from probably the best statistician in the world at the Indian Statistical Institute while sitting in my home in New York, rather than go to a local university and pay $70,000 a year. Okay. So you have a substitution that will change US education, which has been too expensive, and its dominance is unjustified, given that most of the faculty is from other countries. It's even more so, I mean, now that if you see the sectors that in which failure was something extremely well accepted, the technology, well, technology fared very well. And when we look at the numbers in America, you see the stock market rallying. The stock market is not rallying. Technology stocks are rallying, and as they're getting a bigger share of capitalization. We're switching. The American economy, okay, has been dominated now by technology firms, more so than last time. So my logic to re-explain it to our friends listening and watching is as follows. People are afraid of failure. So if you take the most active sector, okay, in the most active country in the world, America has the highest bankruptcy rate in the world. And in America, the sector with the highest bankruptcy rate is technology, okay? And it's the most vibrant one. So now this requires a complete different way of thinking. So in Europe, it was plagued by, and of course India, as well, you're plagued by people who want to help the economy by becoming civil servants. Okay, when you're a good student, okay, failing is not an option. But in real life, it's completely different. So you have to encourage people to fail. And if they want to help the planet, go start a business. Okay, start a business. You're helping the planet a lot more because we need people with the guts to fail. You need to make it socially acceptable for people to try, fail, try again, fail again, okay, until they succeed. And without that, we're not going to get anywhere. You end up having good students who you send them to Harvard, they come back, and then they're going to work for a salary. It's nice to have people work for a salary, but the problem is someone got to generate a salary somewhere, and that person is the entrepreneur. So if you look at the countries where it's easy to fail, you will see growth. If you look at countries where it's not easy to fail, once in a while you see some big investment generated growth and things taper off. This is wonderful because we're plagued. I mean, the three industries that have been helped in America by the government, propped up artificially, were initially the car industry, then the banking industry, and now the airline industry. Or since September 11, the airline, now second time. Then you realize there's the three industries that are that are the worst. We make the worst cars, or made the worst cars for a long time. We have the worst. I am given a choice. I'd rather ride than any non-US airline. So look at the structure of what the exceptions in America. Look what happened to them. Right. It depends on what happens to the COVID part two. Okay. So, but I think that that COVID has given a lot of countries, I cannot talk specifically for India, talk in general, a lot of countries, some kind of impetus. You know, what happened after, I don't know if you're aware of what happened after 1945. You had a boom, okay, some led by investment, Marshall Plan, some just like, you know, boom because the people started overspending, getting out of their house and spending on things, okay? So likewise, we're going to have a worldwide phenomenon if, of course, conditional on dealing with COVID. But the story is not over. So I don't want to be caught making an unconditional statement, but a conditional one, conditional on finishing, being done with COVID. But one good thing I would say about surviving COVID as well, is that now we've learned how to deal with the next pandemic. So the next pandemic is not going to be as costly. And we'll be aware of, you know, its existence, we'll be aware of what to do early to kill it in the egg early on. Now, economically, I'm not an expert on India, nor an expert on economics. I'm a risk person, and of course, and a mathematical modeler for complex nonlinear systems. But I would say that the vibes you get from India are great. And then think about it: you have learned the pharmaceutical industry in India that can supply the rest of the world. And India as well with things. So you may have some kind of positive shocks for a bunch of industries, you know, that will to grow. And then also, as I was saying, that the you may have less of a brain drain. I mean, you guys have been supplying now practically little by little every head of U.S. successful technology company with an Indian CEO. At some point, it got to stop and keep him in India. And the structure of the new world, as our friend Sanjeev was saying, it's not the reiteration of an old world, new world. You can hire employees. Microsoft can hire employees overseas. Just like you can be a remote in Seattle, okay, working for a company in San Francisco, you could be a remote in Bangalore or any place in India working for a company in the US. And the big mistake Donald Trump made is by restricting visas, he thought he was increasing domestic employment. No, that's a silly move. by restricting visas, he encouraged U.S. companies. Now we know how to work remote, so physical presence is no longer that important. And so you're going to be, I mean, you will depend less on demand from, I mean, you'll depend, of course, on demand from overseas, but less than demand, domestic demand. But this will be an icing on a cake, you see, having U.S. companies hire Indians who live in India and stay in India, and perhaps later on may start their own companies in India. So the solution, you know, may come from overseas, from thanks to Zoom, and the idea, the side effect of COVID.
Right.
I mean, COVID has a lot of bad side effects physically, but it has one positive side effect: is I'm sitting in New York now, talking to you in Delhi, without having to incur jet lag. And a lot of companies have employees in India today working for a U.S. company because we didn't know before how to work remote.
Nassim, I would say to that is you're missing out on Indian food, which you love.
You know my passion for Indian food, and with all respect for Indian restaurants in New York, you know, not the same. The yogurt will never, they can replicate probably the chicken, but the yogurt will never, ever be the same. For the right time, never. I would add one thing, that what you say is the bonus you get from having people work in India for a U.S. technology company is the transfer of entrepreneurial spirit. And these people will start companies in India. You see, the probably hire people in the U.S., but the idea of the world becoming flatter thanks to Zoom, as we're witnessing now, is... It's to be taken seriously. You got to take it as logical consequence.
Right. Nassim, one word which you mentioned, which sort of alarmed me, and that's why, let me ask you straight, what is your assessment? From social point of view, from economy point of view, policy point of view, or even from Black Swan event point of view, is worst behind us at this point in time?
I mean, I don't know. I don't know. We have the mechanism to deal with the disease. Okay, with this disease, we have a mechanism to deal with future disease. We have people who were unwise in the beginning are becoming wise now. Like Sweden was unwise compared to Norway. Now they're becoming wise. You see, so hopefully, so I'm sort of like guardedly optimistic that we know how to deal. Even if COVID gets worse, that we know how to deal with it. Even Brazil, you know, that not in Brazil is becoming wiser. Okay, so there are signs, you know, that of maturity in the world that allows us to deal with these contingencies a little better, but. But we have to be careful, you see, that's what I'm saying. You have to be careful because there's a high amount of unpredictability. Mutations can happen, but we have to be careful. And I mean, on a positive side, of course, these vaccines can be adapted to the very quickly to the new strains. But I will stay careful. Plus, there's one thing that worries me is a segment of the population that is in worse ignorance than the middle ages, like people who refuse vaccine, not understanding that vaccines are very risky, maybe.
Right.
But COVID, we know, has, particularly for young people, long-term risks that are very serious. They've got to take seriously. So in the trade-off, and then you have segments in France, thanks to Twitter, thanks to social media, you have a spread of ignorance that makes me, you know, a little more cautious in my assessments of the future. It'll be my 12th visit to India in a decade and a half, and anytime I'm invited, I board the plane.